Welcome to the Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this June the 2nd on the West Coast, now June the 3rd on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to welcome those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network as well, and hope you enjoy tonight's show. It's going to be a very moving show. Why? Well, we have Christopher Holmes, Ph.D., with us. He hosts a show on BBS Radio every second Saturday of the month, and it's called Zero Point. He is a forensic psychologist as well as a metaphysician, a very prolific author, and a wonderful teacher, actually. And we're going to be paying a special tribute to someone very near and dear to him. But first, I picked out a song which is in another language. It's actually in Armenian. So if you speak Armenian or understand Armenian, you're really going to enjoy this song. It's sung by Ani Christie. The song is called Seru Yeraz, and it means love and dream. Let me get this together here. All right, here we go.
Amar, yes, sirumekes, inskoknena. castel, ay, castel in ser.
That was Ani Christy and Seru Yaraz, Love and Dream. I'd like to welcome to the show now my good friend, who I've already partially introduced, Christopher Holmes, PhD. Christopher, welcome to Evident Footprints.
Thanks, Don. It's nice to be back. And I wanted to thank you also for the previous tribute you had done for Karen. I think it was the first Monday after she died on May 6th. Just 4 weeks today ago, and she died quite suddenly. We really had no knowledge that she had heart problems, and she hadn't had signs ahead of time. It was really, and it was such a good day. She had had such a good day and seemed so happy and motivated and clear. And so it was really very sudden. And
well, I've been, I think we've all been through that sort of loss. Of course, you're talking about Karen T. Hale, your life partner. And for those out there that are unaware of who we're talking about, yes, it's really something how she had you take a photograph of her wearing that T-shirt with the David Dees insignia on it. And she was insistent on that, wasn't she?
Yeah, she had made up a series of T-shirts. Like, we're just like both at wit's end sometimes. Like, what do we do, you know, to wake up a brain-dead public? Like, and we thought, oh, we got to get the images out there more. So we did up a bunch of T-shirts, some of them with, like, anti-New World Order logo on and anti-UN, and one with a baby with 50 needles sticking out of them, and one of chemtrails, you know. So we thought, oh, if we can just get these T-shirts out there and people start wearing the images around. And she had done that one of David D, and it depicts a royal wedding, and below it, it shows the wedding dress cast stained with blood red, and it shows a carnage below of people, and it says Iraq, Afghanistan, and all the wars, and it's a shocking image, and I hadn't wanted her to wear it publicly because I thought some people would take offense. Like, some people just don't get it. They still have this kind of fantasy notion of the royal family and elites and such.
Mm-hmm.
So, but she absolutely insisted she wanted her picture taken with that T-shirt on. So, and that was kind of 10 minutes before she died. We were just working around with our garden plants and such, and yeah, she passed very easily in a way in terms of having a massive heart attack, and I think it was she passed within minutes, and she was 55 years old. And we'd been together for the last 12 to 15 years. So she was just a really very special woman, and it's fortunately, when a person who does the type of work that we do in terms of being in the truth movement and kind of wanting to fight for justice and truth in the world, and a person is really lucky then to have some support with a partner who kind of supports that and understands it. You know, one hears of different stories, the problems it causes people in the truth movement, you know, the problems with their families and their partners, and it's very sad in a way what it does to people's lives once you wake up and realize the seriousness of the world situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's you find that not just with family members, friends, and mm-hmm. people that you just meet, even if they open up a discussion. Of course, you want to approach the truth right away. You don't want to beat around the bush. And they have a hard time. You can see the eyeballs sort of roll back into the head and get glazed over, and they just don't want to listen. Now, Karen was quite a bit different. She supported your work, and I sensed that she was a very sensitive human being, that she cared very deeply about people all over the world, and that she was driven to have people know the truth. Am I right about that?
Yeah, she was an avid researcher, like just spent far too many hours on the computer and would take to heart a lot. Even, you know, a bus accident, 26 children would die, and all these kind of different tragedies. She seemed to kind of take them on in a way. And I mean, I've found that, as you know, in my work, I talk about the awakening of the human heart. And mm-hmm. as that happens, then in a way you feel compassion and love and caring for other people's. So for a person like Karen, or for myself, and I'm sure for yourself, when you look at, you know, these deformed children, for instance, in Iraq, and the horrors of that, and the horrors of what those families have been through, and all the horrors of the war, like, in a way, it's like they're your children, they're our children. You know, I think Karen and I both have felt a kind of moral outrage at kind of how people could possibly have done this, like destroyed our society and civilization, and mm-hmm. and you, the more, you know, we only woke up in August of 2006. It was a very kind of dramatic event for us both, and on that occasion, I happened to see the movie Loose Change, which my youngest son had seen in the high school. And until then, I had no concept that there was anything suspicious about 9/11. I just accepted it unthinkingly. And until that point in my life, had really not been interested in politics and really was quite naive. And even that movie, which I consider now, I can see how misleading it is and how much disinfo there is in it and how it takes you on all these side issues and doesn't really come to the crux of the matter. But despite that, when I saw that movie and saw the manner in which those towers came down, like it was like patently obvious that it wasn't airplanes that could have brought the towers down like that. And then you realize it's an obvious deception, and then you realize that the governments have to know this. Like, they obviously know. They're not idiots, you know, and the police and the intelligence services. And then the media are complicit. Mm-hmm. So just from that one movie, it kind of like was this huge, huge shock that, wow, the Canadian population's actually been deceived. I mean, the world population has been deceived about 9/11. And then, you know, immediately once we learned that, you know, then you start watching all the movies on YouTube and Google Video, and you know, you just see all about the false flag events, you know, London train bombings, Oklahoma City, all these things, you know, we've been deceived about. And they do it continuously, and they stage it, and they use the media to intentionally deceive people.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of shocking waking up more and more, and you see... You know, Karen had new grandchildren and the families, you know, oh, we got to get inoculations because the doctors say so, and they just don't grasp the seriousness of it. And they can't imagine that people would actually want to spread illness and diseases through inoculations. And then you try to tell people, look, the chemtrails, like they're poisoning us, like, that the main ingredient's aluminum, and so many people, families now in our community, the parents, grandparents got Alzheimer's. Like, it's just the accumulation of neurotoxins. So we're actually being poisoned. It's like you wake up, and it's like a nightmarish world in a way, beyond what most people could imagine. And it's hard for people, in a way, to be brave and stay in that and try to face it. And then to even try to do something, Karen did, you know, we have worked together over the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Was her awakening simultaneous with your own, would you say? Basically, you both came to the realization of what was going on at the same time?
Yeah, we watched that first movie, and then within days, I mean, we were just... you know, on YouTube constantly just filling in more and more. So, yes, it occurred together. And it was amazing, the period of time. Like, it sent us into, at one point, states of rapture. Actually felt like totally blissed out in a way. We both experienced a certain type of mystical state, I think, as this happened, because it broke down all our false knowledge of our society and our government and our history. It's like everything we've ever been told was a lie. It kind of broke that down very dramatically in both of us, and it kind of led to experiences of ecstasy where we just felt filled with bliss and light, and then periods of dread and kind of fearfulness. Mm-hmm. We went through some quite shocking periods. Maybe next time I'm on, I'll read some of the revelations that came to me through that period, because I actually wrote them down, and they're in one of my books that I hope to publish within a few months.
Yes. Now, you wrote the Heart Doctrine, which we've discussed on some past shows, and I would presume that Karen had an influence on even your writing, didn't she? Because of the closeness of your relationship?
In a way, not too much. In a way, she didn't have that certain type of intellectual interest or capacity. Like, she wasn't that inclined. I say in my acknowledgement of her in the book, she taught me what the Heart Doctrine means in real life.
Mm-hmm.
That's what she did by her example. And in a way, because, like, she had some difficulties, serious kind of difficulties through her life in a way, and I think had a broken heart, and at times went into kind of manic periods, and was like people who go into manic periods, sometimes they enjoy it because it unleashes like a huge amount of energy and creativity. But she would put herself greatly at risk through her efforts. Like, for a period of over a month, she was living on the streets of Toronto and living out of shelters, and felt that she had to be on the street among the street people. And she was like a Saint Mother Teresa or some figure like that, almost. she was always so sympathetic to the worst handicapped or the unfortunate people, like the down and out most.
Mm-hmm.
I remember once sending her $100 to take the bus back from Montreal to Ottawa when she was in Montreal living on the streets. And by the end of the day, she had just kind of, the money went right through her and she just gave it out to all different people. She, in her manic periods, like, it was like a divine mania in ways, and she was like amazingly powerful at such times, but she also really put herself at risk and caused a lot of stress to myself and her family through her actions. But I got off a little bit.
That's all right, because you're describing the emotions and how these events have a way of awakening someone to the point where they notice all the things that are in need of repair, in mm-hmm. our society, the way we treat disabled people or people who have gotten a raw deal. Likely they're out on the street because they've been ripped off in some way, either in their personal relationships or by the government or by big business, or could be a lot of different reasons, but you know that she had a good heart. You know that she opened her heart to help those people. So it wasn't like she was being a tramp for the sake of being a tramp.
Yeah, no, and she wasn't trampish at all. She just,
she had to
be there on the street with mm-hmm. real people with real problems, and put herself at great risk to do that.
Yeah.
It also meant, though, in ways she was confused, and it was so much. Karen, through her life, had also, when she was 18 years old, she used to have anxiety attacks, and she was prescribed Valium. And that kind of became a lifelong addiction until she gave it up, I guess it was 6 years ago. She is finally able to give that up. But that had been a major problem for her, like having anxiety attacks, and then you start taking Valium, and then you habituate to it, so you need more. And then the doctors don't want to give you more because they're afraid, because they have pressure on, because they shouldn't be giving more. And that also led to periods of depression where she felt she'd never get off the Valium, and it's like how the pharmaceutical mafia, they want so many people addicted to so many drugs, and these become lifelong crutches for people. But anyway, she in the last years of our being together, like, she completely kicked that habit and didn't drink or do drugs of any kind. So she had made huge progress in her life in dealing with that addiction, and reaching, by the time she died, is like, I don't think I'd ever seen the nobility of her soul to the extent to which I'd seen it just that day and in that picture. Knowing of her, to me, what that represents is the kind of proud look in her face.
Yes. There.
It's interesting in that picture because, it was just coincidence, but behind her, it looks like she has a halo, and that is a picture of the Mother Mary and Christ Child on the wall behind her. So it kind of gave her a halo, which seemed really appropriate.
Yes, I didn't mean to sound like I was calling her a tramp.
I didn't. Yeah. I didn't take it like that.
If you're out on the street, you're worthless, or you haven't taken care of business properly, and that's, we know with what's going on in this country right now, all the foreclosures on homes, and you don't hear about the tent cities where mm-hmm. where people have been evicted from their homes illegally, unlawfully evicted, by the way. through a continuation of this bank corruption and mortgage corruption and bureaucracy corruption on a federal, state, and local level. And these people aren't getting attention. So it's obvious that when one wakes up, one opens up the heart, that they're going to start caring about people.
Yeah.
And the first, I think it's natural to try to help the people that that are easiest to get to, you know, easiest to reach out to. I'm sure she had quite a number of stories to share with you as to.
So some wild stories, both that she had and things we did together and things that happened to me. We woke up in August of 2006. So September 11th of 2006, Karen and I were the only ones on Parliament Hill with signs saying 9/11 was an inside job, and other signs. And I had written an article up explaining how 9/11 was a fraud and saying something about who did it and why it was a fraud. And we were up on Parliament Hill, and we thought there'd be thousands of people up there protesting and, like, who were awake. And we get there, and we're, like, only two people. So it was funny. I mean, we did that. And when we had another day, I think we got picked up. Like, I don't think you go to Parliament Hill in Ottawa and do something like that and not get noticed by the intelligence and police. And I think Karen and I have both been subject through the last years, her particularly, to gang stalking. I think that's been an aspect of the problem she's had through the years a bit. I don't know. There's a lot of mysteries for me. Around things she went through and what was real and not real in them. And another thing we did that was, I think, that showed our bravery, in a sense, was we were watching TV one day when the Montreal shooting occurred at Dawson College, another one of these concocted shootings. And we could tell just from analyzing, she was on the computer listening to internet radio from Montreal where it had an eyewitness on the radio. And I was going back and forth through to TV channels. And just through analyzing it and watching it, I wrote up a 4 or 5 page article explaining. I could see it was a fraud from the news coverage because the witnesses were completely, what they had said was completely ridiculous and inconsistent and illogical. And we picked up this just from our analysis of the media coverage of that day. And I wrote it up, and then we went to Montreal just a couple of days after the shooting and gave out copies of this ad in Montreal. Not of this ad, but of the article explaining it as a false flag event. But again, nothing seemed to come of that. And I think we may have just been intercepted by people who were kind of agents who just absorb our article, and nothing ever became of it. Certainly no police ever wanted to inquire into any of these things.
Yeah, it was similar when we had Columbine, the shootings at Columbine High School, the Murrah building, the A.P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, 9/11, the Buffalo plane crash that killed Beverly Eckert, who was suing the government over the loss of her son in a bogus war. That whole plane load of people was taken out just to get to her.
Yeah.
And they had witnesses lined up that all were lying through their teeth about who they were and where they lived. And as I was investigating that while I was on the radio doing a show.
I remember that at the time. And you see, it's pre-scripted. I remember one of the things was that the reporters were kind of jumping on the conclusion that I think it was ice on the wings. Even, and I remember the investigators saying, well, hold on, we haven't determined yet. And it was like the media were hyping that even ahead of time. Yeah, the media is pre-scripted. That's what I don't think people grasp at all. Like, they think the media report news events occurring independently of them as media. But really, the media are often pre-scripted. Like 9/11, they had pre-scripted witnesses because they had to have witnesses who saw the airplanes, and they had to have witnesses who could testify that the airplanes flew into the building so ever so neatly that you couldn't see the airplane anymore, and they just disappeared inside. Which is, like, totally ridiculous as to what would truly unfold in that scenario.
The BBC,
so they script the news, and then you see things, sometimes you see things that are reported first on the media, but then those were things that shouldn't have been reported, like Dan Rather at the Pentagon saying, well, I don't see any airplane, oh, no, Jamie McIntyre, I think. He's saying, I don't see any evidence of an airplane here. There's no major tail section, wings, or anything. And then he had to recant about 5 years later, which he did.
Yeah, they actually had people lined up and had a handler there telling the news media which person to interview next. And he had all these ridiculous explanations. And while that was going on, they'd cut to the BBC broadcasting that Building 7 had collapsed, and it was still standing there while they were saying
I've seen that clip.
It
just shows us that, the media help to stage. The media's job is the mass hypnosis of the American public and to deceive the American public about every major national and international event that occurs on a daily basis, and that's what they do. So the people, they think it's very reasonable that the American taxpayer pay, tens of trillions of dollars to the bankers who just committed bank fraud and all kinds of illegal securities.
Fraud.
Racketeering, essentially. Yeah. And bank fraud, and then the American public's going to bail them all out, and the media sells it as something we have to do, and to save the nation and to save the economy, and it's all just propaganda.
And if you don't go along with it, you're not a true American, and the rest of the world sees it for the farce that it is. That's what's crazy about it. There's the average American is so dependent upon mainstream news being the gospel of what's going on in the world, and the rest of the world is saying, why don't you people wake up? We know it's an inside job. We know who is behind it. Why don't you know it?
Well, I don't think they're saying that in Canada. I think Canada is just the same as the U.S. is the vast majority of people are completely oblivious of what's being done. They don't grasp it.
Well, I think that's pretty much the case on the whole Western Hemisphere, actually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At least down to Central America. It all has to do with censorship and propaganda.
Yeah.
Now, not to change subjects, but what was Karen's background that gave her the insight and the drive to do what she did? What kind of work or what was she interested in career-wise?
Well, she used to, on her zero-point business card, she used to have CPR, which I thought was nice because I always felt, she kind of resuscitated my heart, kind of. But what it stood for, correspondence, photography, and researcher. So those were some of her interests. I mean, she in her life has five children, so she was a mother for most of her life, and the last 10 to 12 years has worked with me just with what I do through my writing and talks and zero-point activity. So she didn't really have a profession. She was the kind of person, in a way, could never hold a regular 9-to-5 job. She would never be able to conform in that type of environment. She needed a special kind of environment a bit.
She sounds like she was a free spirit then.
She was. She was totally free spirit, and she said she could never stay anywhere where there wasn't love. And so she had left different relationships, and in a way, she wouldn't be willing to submit to kind of authority, like just random authority and such.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was a really creative free spirit. She liked horseback riding. She was happiest when she was climbing on logs when we went out to BC and went up on the coast, and she could walk along all these huge, big logs, and she loved nature and animals. And oh, she had been an organic garlic farmer for several years and ran that as a business.
Oh, so very, very diversified interests then.
Yeah, she did, yeah.
What were her tastes like in music? Did she sort of like a little bit of everything? Was she sort of a cosmopolitan listener?
We had particular bands and groups that were really part of our relationship. I don't know if you've ever heard of Tea Party, which was a Canadian kind of fairly heavy rock band, but they do nice ballads. And have you ever heard of Tea Party?
I get a lot of email from Tea Party via India, but same group.
Yeah, they did a song called Heaven Coming Down, which was their most famous international hit. Sarah Brightman, Sarah McLachlan. We like that. We both like kind of romantic, spacious music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, things along that line. Kate Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Creed, you know, different, somewhat varied tastes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I sense that she had, let's say, a craving for the spiritual side of a song. Or a performer.
Yeah, she liked that. All those musics I mentioned had that spiritual element to their songs and the lyrics and the kind of sound of the songs.
Well,
yeah, she. Well, I had wondered if I might recount a poem Karen wrote. It was a children's poem, which is up on my website. It's called "You Are a Star."
Yes, you may. I was going to ask you to do that. So, please.
Okay. Please. And as I go through it, I'm going to say a little bit about the meaning of it, because this concept, "You Are a Star," partly in Alex Aleister Crowley says the first principle of magic is that every man and woman is a star. And what's meant by that in your magical nature, it is said that everybody has like a spark of holiness or a God spark, some element, like a point light element. Mm-hmm. So that is the star nature. And Aleister Crowley talks about the mysteries of what he calls Hadit and Nui. And Hadit, H-A-D-I-T, is the name for the star nucleus. And Nui is from French, and it means night.
Yes.
So you might imagine a whole bunch of stars in the sky at night. And that's so Hadit within Nui is the conjunction of the point source of light within Nui, which is the feminine for space. So you are a star is this kind of ancient mystical idea, not just from Crowley, but it's in Kabbalah and it's in Blavatsky, that we have a kind of a God spark within the human being. So it reads, "You are a star, birthed from within without the night. You are a star reflecting some light. You are a star. That's what you are. You are a star. You are a star that cries out, I am, before flight. And I don't know if you know Kabbalistic teachings, but when the monad or the spiritual spark comes down out of the supernal triad, the top three spheres, it crosses what's called the abyss. And when that element emerges out of the abyss, it is said in Kabbalah, it cries out, I am. You see, so that's what she's saying. You are a star that cries out, I am, before flight. You are a star that's been pushed out into the light. You are a star, that's what you are. You are a star. You are a star filled with luminous light. You are a star, blissful and bright. You are a star, that's what you are. You are a star. You are a star, a pearl of great price. You are a star stuck in a jar. You are a star, that's what you are. You are a star. You are a star turned topsy-turvy from the flight. You are a star filled with limitless light. You are a star, that's what you are. You are a star. You are a star playing hide-and-seek in God's place. You are a star within the heart space. See, here is in my teaching about the origins of consciousness, I talk about there being a divine source emanation, or the star element, and then it's associated with the heart space, which it represents the divine mother. So you are a star within the heart space. You are a star. That's what you are. You are a star. You are a star that heals with a smile. You are a star. That's who you are. You are a star. You are a star reflecting sunlight. You are a star no matter where you are. You are a star stuck in a jar. You are a star in a jar. And it ends there. And partly the concept, there's a famous quote by a Sufi mystic who said, Rumi, who says, inside this jar are seven oceans and innumerable stars. And so, oh no, it's Kabir, the poet, not Rumi, it's Kabir. And the concept is that he's saying inside a jar, like a container, he says there are seven oceans. And that has to do with the idea throughout mystical teachings that hyperspace is seven dimensional. So space is seven levels to it. So he says there are seven oceans and innumerable stars. So you could imagine all these stars in these different oceans. So that's partly Karen's association. You are a star in a jar. So it's kind of referencing in part the poetry of Kabir. But it's also like you are a star stuck in the body. See, that our body is our jar, or our life is our jar. So it's also representing that, like it's a star stuck in the body or vehicle of experience.
Or the vessel, lifetime. She's not saying star as in an idol.
No.
Not at all.
No, what she's referring to is this concept that there's that divine God element within the human being, the star element, the star nucleus. Mm-hmm. It's like the first point of supernal light within the human being. So yes. That's your star nature.
Now, in your writing, when you were writing the Heart Doctrine, you already have said that Karen was instrumental in causing your own heart awakening, in a sense, even though you had all of this esoteric knowledge from your studies and your work. Did you get into debates with her on any of the issues, or did she give you insights that maybe she didn't read but had anyway?
It was more by her actions, kind of like her compassion for the disadvantaged, mm-hmm. her kind of bravery. In a way, she was like a road warrior, kind of like she was so brave in the things that she would do. So she was kind of had a certain nobility of heart and courage. And integrity, like I never saw her be violent or express violent thoughts to people in my life. I'd never seen that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also, in a way, just seeing the tragedy of what she went through and being exposed myself then to some of what she was going through, through my involvement in trying to help her during those times where she felt she had to be out there like that. So it was more seeing, less the intellectual or even intuitive knowledge, like to extend my research. It was more seeing what that meant, like someone who was really heart-centered and what that entailed.
Mm-hmm. Did she ever mention that she saw many of the things that happened in her life were, let's say, the result of karmic debt that she may have incurred?
No, I don't remember that.
Ever?
Well, a karmic debt from this life more so than karmic debt from a prior life, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, because even within this life, we can pay off karmic debt. I mean, sometimes people use the term and it refers to, like, past karma from past lives, but karma also applies to the karma you accumulate in this life, and you can pay off that karma as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the reason I asked that question was just sensing, you know, when a person goes suddenly like that, usually, if they're in the midst of paying off karmic debt, they're not going to be deprived of that opportunity to work through it. And I have the sense that she accomplished what she came here to accomplish, despite how we may feel about that. If you look at the bigger picture, it makes a lot of sense that a person would be called to some other reality because they had accomplished their mission at that point. Now, in our nature as human beings, in our emotional nature, and the way we become attached to other people and almost dependent upon them, we are the ones that have the difficulty dealing with the departure. But if you look at it just in that simple sense, I think my sense is that she was called because she had worked through all those issues. You may disagree with me.
Well, no, but, actually, Don, that is how I completely felt myself. And because I'd never seen her as settled and happy and active and meaningfully engaged as I'd seen her over the past 6 months. And that day in particular, like, she was up and cleaned up the house and made breakfast and doing all these things, and she was absolutely determined. You know, I don't know, that she had that clarity about her that I'd never seen, and I think she was happier over the last 6 months than I'd known her through her 12, 15 years of knowing her.
Yeah.
She was really settled and attained something in herself. That's why I said on my kind of tribute to her, like, you are a star. Like, in a way, when I say that, you are a star, Gurdjieff would say a person has to attain your eye. Like, attain your, like, that's, to attain your eye is to become a star, like, to, and I think Karen had done that, and I think she did that, and she died in her 55th year, which is funny because she had said previously, years ago, that she thought she would die at 55, and 55 is kind of a number of double perfection, like the five-pointed triangle is often considered a kind of symbol of perfection.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, I really felt that she was taken, that she had attained something, that she her heart had been healed over the years, and she had gotten beyond that those addictions, which had been such a lifelong problem for her. And yeah. She had a real sense of purpose and clarity, like I'd never seen her have before. So your comments were totally appropriate, and that's how I had to take it. I thought for myself, and your second point you were saying about how, in a way, her passing, in a way, it's harder on me. I stuck here behind. It's like, you know, I would do so much of my day. It would be activity with Karen, and mm-hmm. then to have that kind of emptiness in your life. And, you know, it's nice to share life experiences and share with someone. I particularly like that. I'm not used to being single. You know, I've usually been in long-term relationships. So it is harder on people left behind in a way. I kind of long to see her again. And for me, I have to try to take her death just to give me courage to kind of move ahead to do what we were both wanting to do.
Yeah.
And you know, feel that someday if I earn it, then I'll see her again.
Well, Christopher, the time is really flying here. I'm going to ask you if you would think of what she would tell people, how she would inspire people, if in her words, to wake up or to accept responsibility, personal responsibility for the things that have gone in their life, and some words of encouragement that she would share with people, sort of as a solution. But while you're thinking about that, I want to play another song. I picked these two songs out of thin air, and this is another Armenian singer. I know this Armenian composer, Robert Amirkanyan. He's very famous, and he's the conductor of the Armenian Youth Orchestra as well. But he's very, very established as a composer, arranger, orchestrator, and conductor. And this is his daughter, Maria Amirkanyan, singing a song called Karot, which is carrot. It would be like measuring the value in gold.
Karot mi visht meset hin oreri Ein hin laboreri Ein hin zaf siro Mer hokun sirtin kyankin mer voch Terena Terena parkin mer voj Lerutan mec im ser Dohume im sirto sirta. Gore na mi bar mi hoska se. Yes, ako tu man kes. An hunieras tknach papier bei zar.
Amirkanian, and I believe it's her father, Robert Amirkanian. The arrangement is by Tigran Sakian. Beautiful music comes out of Armenia, and for some reason tonight, Christopher, I just felt compelled to pull those two songs.
Well, they're both beautiful. I know Karen would like them. And I'd like to thank you, Don. Karen and I, for the last 2 years, we'd listen to your show late at night, eh? She so liked your show, and she'd always be on the computer in the other room while I was on the phone with you, and always gave me that support and feedback. So she really, thank you on Karen's behalf.
Well,
and I thought of what the message Karen would have said. What I'll tell you what she wrote on a piece of Bristol board and stuck up in our front window, and it was, "Wake up now." she was tired of it, like, "Wake up now, come on, people, wake up, you know. This is too important, you know. We felt we were elders a bit. Someone's got to be brave out there." So she was a courageous and brave woman, Karen was. And I'd like to thank you, Don, to allow me to have this tribute to Karen this evening.
Well, we're going to do two more shows this month on the 16th and on the 30th, where you're going to be discussing more about her work. Again, my condolences to you, Christopher. I know it's a difficult time, but there are people praying for you, and your work is too important to allow yourself to be pulled down by the loss, because, and I mean emotionally, I know you well enough to know that you'll make it through. And I could feel her listening to the show tonight.
She would have. Yeah, you really, Don. She would have. What's it makes your ears burn or something? What's the expression? She would have been listening tonight. I totally believe that. I felt her around with me quite often. Sometimes, you know, it's like you want to see something visual or hear a voice. But sometimes it's more subtle than that. It's just feeling, and sometimes it's just feeling in the heart. I can feel in my heart sometimes that she's present around. And I had the most amazing incident this last week. Going, I have her ashes in my living room, actually, where I have a kind of flowers and a poster of all pictures of her, a tribute to her, and I found, going through her things, her two angel pictures, these beautiful kind of angel pictures, and I put them up over the altar, and I was just spending the evening, and I look up, and her favorite symbol was the dragonfly, and there's like the places adorned with her different dragonfly things, and I look up in the corner of the room, and there's a spider web, and there is a dragonfly caught in the spider web. And it was funny. It was just like one of those things that I felt, oh, that's a sign to me that, like, she's gone. Like, that's the dried-up body, but she's gone. She's been released into spirit. And I felt that she would have had angels to protect her, because I think she deserved them and had them at times in her life, providing her some protection. And Don, next time we won't continue on. I'd like to kind of go into the revelations that occurred to me when I woke up during that period with Karen, and kind of focus on those revelations, and then maybe share some of the kind of things we went through during a very erratic kind of period of time.
Okay. Yes, that would be very interesting.
Okay, and listeners, you can see my tribute to Karen's up on my website. It'll be off the front page in a day or so, and I'm going to put a little bit more up there on her at zeropoint.ca. And, thanks, Don, very much, and thanks, BBS Radio, again, and we'll talk again in 2 weeks, Don.
Yes, thank you for being on the show, and you're on not this coming Saturday, but a week from this Saturday, right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, and that's on bbsradio.com, Station 1 on Saturday. So that'll be the second Saturday of this month. Christopher, it's been a pleasure having you on the show, and I feel I even know you much better knowing these things about Karen Hale. And again, our sympathy. And I know that you're going to use this as a means to become even stronger with your message.
Yes.
I sense that.
Yeah.
So thank you. And
you
have a good night as well.
Good night.
Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to BBSRadio.com, Evident Footprints. And I'd like to thank Wind Talkers Radio Network for broadcasting the show. Also, over at BBS Radio, we had Seth Hendrick on the sound. I'd like to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. Certainly, I want to thank Christopher Holmes for his contribution this evening. And you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me tomorrow night when my special guest will be my co-host, our resident science advisor, scientist, inventor, Jim Murray. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.